Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for November 18th, Saturday, reading of the Arapaho County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Denver judge keeps Trump on ballot, rejecting challenge under Constitution's insurrection clause, by Nicholas Riccardi. Budget cuts from slumping pot sales hitting Aurora homeless programs, by Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. County restricts oil, gas developments, by Nina Joss. Black leaders criticize Cherry Creek schools for handling of racist video, by Taylor Shaw. Reinke Brothers in Littleton files for bankruptcy after 55 years in community, by Nina Joss. Residents of nearby complex displace after fire breaks out at construction site in Littleton, by Nina Joss. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Denver judge keeps Trump on ballot, rejecting challenge under Constitution's insurrection clause. Denver. A Colorado judge on Friday found that former President Donald Trump engaged in insurrection during the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, but rejected an effort to keep him off the state's primary ballot because it's unclear whether a Civil War era constitutional amendment barring an insurrectionist from public office applies to the presidency. The lawsuit, brought by a left-leaning group on behalf of a group of Republican and independent Colorado voters, contended that Trump's actions related to the attack ran afoul of a clause in the 14th Amendment that prevents anyone from holding office who engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution. The decision by District Judge Sarah B. Wallace is the third ruling in a little over a week against lawsuits seeking to knock Trump off the ballot by citing Section 3 of the amendment. The Minnesota Supreme Court last week said Trump could remain on the primary ballot because political parties have sole choice over who appears, while a Michigan judge ruled that Congress is the proper forum for deciding whether Section 3 applies to Trump. In her decision, Wallace said she found that Trump did, in fact, engage in insurrection on January 6th and rejected his attorney's arguments that he was simply engaging in free speech. Normally, that would be enough to disqualify him under Section 3, but she said she couldn't do so for a presidential candidate. Section 3 does not specifically refer to the presidency, as it does members of the U.S. Senate or House of Representatives. Instead, the clause refers to elector of president and vice president, along with civil and military offices. Part of the court's decision is its reluctance to embrace an interpretation which would disqualify a presidential candidate without a clear, unmistakable indication that such is the intent of Section 3, the judge wrote. Budget cuts from slumping pot sales hitting Aurora homeless programs. Aurora. A shortfall of millions of dollars could tear holes in Aurora's safety net for homeless residents starting in 2024, with cold weather sheltering, temporary housing, and meal programs at risk of vanishing due to a lack of funding. The situation mostly reflects a decrease in retail marijuana sales, which are taxed by the city to fund homelessness services and youth violence prevention efforts. In September, the city reported the marijuana sales tax revenues fell by 11% in 2022 and that revenues were down by about 8.5% in 2023. In total, the amount of marijuana funds available to homelessness services agencies dropped from $3.9 million for 2023 to $1.4 million to 2024. At the same time, federal COVID-19 relief funds are drying up as pandemic-specific grants end and the city's remaining American Rescue Plan Act money is spent down. Between August and September, Aurora invited grant applications for programs serving the city's several hundred homeless residents. And city staffers shared their recommendations for funding during a city council committee meeting in October. Some of the city's largest homelessness service providers say the cuts have the potential to endanger their clients' physical safety and their progress toward obtaining stable housing. People won't get fed. They won't be having case management. They won't have emergency shelter. They won't have emergency outreach during cold days, said Bob Dorshimmer, CEO of Mile High Behavioral Health Care. The impact this will have on the Aurora Day Resource Center is significant. With a funding cut, it can't operate at $200,000 7 days a week, and it will not be able to operate as a cold weather shelter because there will not be staff to do that. Mile High oversees the Aurora Day Resource Center, which offers emergency shelter to homeless residents when temperatures reach 20 degrees or colder. The facility in North Aurora offered shelter to approximately 5,100 individuals during the previous cold season. Mile High also administers the Comptus Crisis Center, where a kitchen for preparing meals, about $190,000 last year, and a case management program for families could both shut down for lack of funding. The agency's outreach work could also be defunded. Dorshimmer said about 75% of Mile High's funding comes from the city of Aurora. Currently, Mile High is set to receive $713,000 from the city in 2014 for all of its programs, compared to about $2.4 million in 2023. While $300,000 of Mile High's funding in 2023 came from a pandemic-related community development block grant, the majority of the decrease reflects marijuana tax shortfalls. One client of Mile High, Ivan Maury, became homeless in Aurora after medical problems cost him his job with FedEx and consequently the room at a motel where he had been living for 2.5 years. Since January, Maury has been sleeping at the Comatis Crisis Center, during which time he said he's seen Mile High connect numerous homeless people with jobs. Comatis is located near Maury's doctors at the University of Colorado Hospital, though he said he's close to moving into an apartment with the support he's received through Mile High. "This place will help you get housing and help you with a job," he said. "If they take that away, you're going to see more people in the streets." Jen, who asks to give only her first name, citing the fact that she became homeless after fleeing an abusive relationship in January, said staffers at Comatis helped connect her with mental health care and that she is close to securing an apartment with their help. She described the support offered through Comatis, the Aurora Day Resource Center, and Mile High as a lifeline for homeless clients, warning that people who are in need of mental health services in particular will be vulnerable if outreach and other services are scaled back. "You're going to have a lot of people not wanting to live, and if you think the hospitals are going to do anything for us, think again," she said. "There is nowhere for us to turn, so if funding for this place goes down, it's going to get worse. And honestly, we get no respect as human beings. We're treated like dirt, even the ones who don't leave trash around." It remains unclear how the potential reduction in shelter space and other services would impact the effectiveness of the city's ban on homeless camping, which supporters say forces homeless people to engage with service providers. Maori and Jen both said sweeps of encampments have only succeeded in displacing homeless campers, who often set up tents again a short distance from where they were evicted from, an observation that has been echoed since the camping ban's introduction by local service providers. In 2022, the conservative majority of Aurora City Council codified the city's current policy for dealing with unsheltered homelessness, including sweeping camps as long as there is enough shelter space to accommodate campers and pursuing work-first policies that prioritize employment as a way for homeless people to improve their lives. Aurora City Council member Allison Combs said progressives plan to bring forward a proposal to make up for the shortfall using council discretionary funds and unspent ARPA dollars during the council's November 20th study session. That is the approach that I'm trying to pursue so that hopefully we can get the support of all of the council to ensure we continue to have a shelter and other services without getting into ideological conflicts, she said. Whether or not the proposal is successful will depend on the majority's interest in spending more city funds to backfill lost marijuana tax revenue and COVID-19 relief funds. Mayor Pro Tem Curtis Gardner and Councilmember Dustin Jvanek both said they would wait to see Progressive's proposal before deciding whether to support it or not. They said they were unaware of any competing proposals to fully fund homelessness services coming from council conservatives. Staff will bring something forward, I'm sure, Jvanek said. I know that in the cold weather months, there's always going to be a higher demand for services, so I'm sure they'll bring forward something to ensure that we can adequately support those who are going to be facing the cold weather conditions in the coming months. However, city spokesman Ryan Luby said a proposal and the ultimate decision to backfill a shortfall with other funds would rest with the city council as a body, not staff. Gardner previously proposed cutting taxes on marijuana to help dispensaries that have struggled as sales have fallen since the pandemic. He said Tuesday that he is still exploring the idea. Mile High is just one of the agencies bracing for significant cuts. Kristen Balliot of the Salvation Army said the organization is probably looking at a shortfall of hundreds of thousands of dollars next year that could force it to close one of its two pallet shelter locations in Aurora. The small, prefabricated housing units have been described by supporters as an effective and popular path to stability for the many homeless people who avoid group shelter facilities due to concerns about safety and the security of their property. The Salvation Army operates 96 of the shelters located at the organization's warehouse on Peoria Street and at Restoration Christian Ministries on East 6th Avenue and provides meals, showers, and case management for residents. My hope is that we'll continue the conversations with the City of Aurora to ensure that we have funding for those for the programs that we operate. Because the reality is that the unhoused population or those that have been displaced from housing is a city issue, Balliot said. It is the city's responsibility to respond to the needs of its citizens, and we step in to help at the request of cities to support in whatever way that we can, but our operations are funded by the city. The organization is bracing for a cut of at least $1.1 million, with most of the difference attributable to the conclusion of grants related to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Salvation Army asked for a total of $1,130,520 in federal emergency solutions grant funding and marijuana tax dollars to fund pallet shelters in 2024. City staffers recommended they be approved for $228,088 in total grants. Separately, the city contributed $600,000 in general fund dollars for the pallet shelter program in 2023 and is expected to contribute the same amount in 2024. A $1,026,202 contribution of ARPA dollars from Aurora to the Salvation Army for pallet shelters is expected to be spent completely in 2024. All but one of the eight organizations that were tentatively approved for funding through the latest homelessness grant process would be given less money than they asked for. We have significantly less funding available this year than we did in prior years, and that's mostly because marijuana tax revenue has been down, Emma Knight, the city's manager of homelessness, told the Housing, Neighborhood Services, and Redevelopment Policy Committee in October. Aurora Mental Health and Recovery asked for $264,865 to fund drug and alcohol detox, outreach, mental health care, and limited night shelter for the city's homeless. They were approved for $100,000 and could take a cut of more than $120,000 compared to last year's funding levels. The organization is separately slated to get about $7 million in ARP funds from the city for its proposed crisis and acute care campus, which will include permanent supportive housing and help the organization serve homeless clients. However, the campus is not projected to open until the end of 2025. Chief Clinical Officer Kristen Anderson said in a statement that Aurora Mental Health and Recovery was disappointed to learn about the potential cuts. From Aurora Mental Health and Recovery's perspective, the services we provide with the city funding are critical and essential to our most vulnerable populations, Anderson said. We will be looking for alternative funding solutions to keep all of our homeless services intact. However, if we aren't able to find that funding, we will then be having to make difficult decisions regarding those services. Beliut, too, said the Salvation Army will continue to look for other sources to fully fund its pallet shelters. Dorshimmer said cities, counties, and the state government are the primary funders of shelter services, and that charitable foundations have shifted their focus to investing in Housing First programs. If nothing else, he said the shortfall has united nonprofits behind the common goal of ensuring Aurora's homeless residents have help and a place to go during the cold season of 2024. I'm at least excited that all of our nonprofits are interested in securing flat funding to keep homeless services together for one more year, to allow more time for us to have thoughtful budget conversations, he said. Dog, who survived 72 days in Colorado mountains after owner's death, is regaining weight back on hiking trails. By Amy Beth Hansen, Associated Press. Pagosa Springs. A faithful dog who survived after spending more than 10 weeks by her owner, who died of hypothermia while hiking in the Colorado mountains, has regained most of the weight she lost during her ordeal and is back on the trails, the family said Thursday. Rich Moore, 71, of Pagosa Springs, set out with his Jack Russell Terrier named Finney to climb Blackhead Peak on August 19th. But didn't return home. A days-long search between the peak and his vehicle was unsuccessful. A hunter found his body and a very protective Finney in the San Juan Mountains of southwestern Colorado on October 30th. Finney had lost about half her body weight, and her ribs were visible, officials have said. Less than 3 weeks later, Finney is doing well, Moore's wife, Dana Holby told the Associated Press on Thursday. She has gained almost all of her weight back, and her strength is almost where it was. She is the miracle dog. She does have an injury on her snout that might leave a scar, Holby said. She is now three, very clingy, and will not let me out of her sight, Holby said. Her ravenous appetite has calmed down, but at first she could not get enough to eat and wanted food at all times of the day and night. Finney's survival story has made her famous on the hiking trails around Pagosa Springs, Holby said. People say, "Is that Finney?" to which Holby responds with an enthusiastic yes. She is such a comfort to me and a great companion on hikes, covering 4 to 5 miles a day, Holby said. I know that she was with Rich to the very end, and somehow that should be a comfort. I don't know how she did it, but she was there when he needed her, Holby said. County restricts oil, gas developments. After approving several amendments to its oil and gas facility regulations in October, the Arapahoe County Board of County Commissioners recently adopted several new, more rules, making its regulations some of the most stringent in the state. The new oil and gas facility regulations, approved in a 3-2 vote on November 14th, extend the distance oil and gas operations can be to homes and other occupied structures. In addition, the new regulations call for water, noise, and air quality monitoring and soil contamination testing. After about 2 hours of public comment, Commissioners Jessica Campbell Swanson, Leslie Summey, and Carrie Warren Gully voted to approve the proposed changes. Our job as a board is to protect human and environmental health, and that is what we are doing while still allowing for oil and gas operations, Campbell Swanson said. I'm proud of the work our community has done, that our county staff has done, and how industry has been willing to collaborate on this prudent and protective regulatory program. The new regulations will apply to all future oil and gas structures in the county. Setbacks. The new regulations require standard setbacks from occupied structures to be 3,000 feet, with a possibility for oil and gas developers to reduce this to as little as 1,000 feet, in some cases with special permission. Occupied structures include homes, offices, retail spaces, schools, churches, and any other place that people would occupy, said Jason Reynolds, the county's planning division manager. Based on his team's research, Arapahoe County now has the largest occupied structure setback requirements in the state, Reynolds said. Boulder County generally requires oil and gas facilities to be 2,500 feet from homes and schools, and the statewide setback rule is 2,000 feet, with exceptions. Prior to the approval, the county's standard setback from occupied structures was 2,000 feet. Environmental advocates and Arapahoe County residents who live near current and proposed oil and gas facilities advocated for larger setbacks for months. Recent conversations about oil and gas facility regulations were triggered by a proposed oil and natural gas project called Lowry Ranch. The proposed project, put forward by an oil and gas company called Civitas Resources, would be at a 33,440-acre site east of Aurora, including areas near the Aurora Reservoir. In October, the county approved 1 mile setbacks from existing and planned reservoirs, unless downgrading conditions can be demonstrated. After that decision, community members still wanted setbacks from residential and other areas, triggering the commissioners to evaluate the round of regulations they approved this week. Jared Bynum, an environmental justice advocate for Colorado Rising, said he is cautiously optimistic about the 3,000-foot standard setback. He added that his group stands with their partner advocates at Save the Aurora Reservoir, that have been requesting standard setbacks of 1 mile from reservoirs, waterways, and occupied structures with no exceptions. But the decision to put setbacks at 3,000 feet is a step in the right direction. Coming from a county commission that is traditionally a little bit more conservative around these things, we think that's representative of great progress, Bynum said. The new regulations also include specific setback regulations and review processes for facilities near waterways, landfills, and more. Monitoring and testing. In addition to the setback changes, the county's new rules require operators to generate ground and surface water quality plans. They also require operators to pay for repeated air quality and noise level testing to ensure compliance with regulations. These requirements go beyond current state regulations set by the Colorado Energy and Carbon Management Commission and the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, a press release from the county said. In an incident where fluids move off of a well pad, operators are required to test for soil contamination and develop remediation plans if there is contamination. Not all supported the new regulations. I've watched in the industry when basically someone comes and tries to regulate too much and too fast and not have the proper context of things. It ends up shutting down a lot of the businesses, said one public commenter, who used to work with the Bureau of Indian Affairs with oil and gas. Everybody cares about being safe. Everybody wants to be fair. Nobody's out to try to hurt anybody, but there is a limit to where regulations step too far. District 3 Commissioner Jeff Baker, who voted against the new regulations along with District 5 Commissioner Bill Holen, said he heard from the community that the process was too fast and he was not in favor of rushing it. We all agree that the health and safety of our citizens is priority number one. But there are also other things where we have to consider property rights, legal things, he said. Even though I voted against it, I think a lot of the rules that we passed yesterday are going to, one, provide a safe and secure environment to our citizens. And I don't object to those, per se. I just thought we needed to have more public comment before we approve them. County spokesperson Chris Henning said county staff started developing the most recent slate of regulations after the county's October 10th meeting. Reynolds said the county wanted to address new regulations quickly so they could be in place when potential new oil and gas applications, which they are expecting any day now, are submitted. Prior to the Board of County Commissioners' official decision, the Planning Commission voted unanimously to deny the proposed regulations at its November 8th meeting. In early 2024, the county will discuss more oil and gas regulations related to reverse setbacks, inspection programs, refining air quality regulations, and more. Black leaders criticize Cherry Creek schools for handling a racist video. Officials with the NAACP and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Colorado Holiday Commission raised concerns about student safety following the spread of a video showing a Cherry Creek Middle School student expressing hatred against black people. In the video, shared with Colorado Community Media, a child used a racial slur and said black people should not be alive right now. The child said that he hates the color of their skin. According to the Rocky Mountain NAACP, the video is of a West Middle School student and was shot in September. The Cherry Creek School District responded on November 15th, the same day as the press conference. The district said that it was first made aware of the racist video was recorded in September, and that it was created outside of a school setting by the student and shared in a group text. The language in the video is hate-filled, and we took swift action to address this unacceptable behavior, the school district said in a statement. Administration and law enforcement acted immediately to investigate the situation. The district added, students found to be responsible faced significant discipline, and their parents were responsive to the severity of the situation. Due to the privacy rights of students, we cannot discuss specifics of discipline. Portia Prescott, the president of the Rocky Mountain NAACP, said that she has received comments from concerned parents about the video since it first surfaced about a month ago, expressing fear for student safety. The Rocky Mountain NAACP State Conference said it had been informed of black students being threatened and considered the matter concerning enough to warrant an emergency press conference. We are late, obviously, 2 months later, but unfortunately that's how viral works, Prescott said while standing outside of West Middle School. It got to a bunch of kids. Prescott said a clip of the student was reshared online and eventually shared with children who showed it to their parents. According to the school district, a letter was sent to West Middle School families on September 29th from Monica Garcia, the school principal. In that letter, Garcia said the school dealt with some incidents of racist speech at our school and in our community, calling it unacceptable. The principal included a resource for families to talk with children about discriminatory behavior and hate-motivated language. Although the school district took action, Prescott said school leaders should have addressed it more publicly and shared information on a school website with resources for students and families. Vern L. Howard, the chairman of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Colorado Holiday Commission, said parents have expressed concern that the district did not handle the situation properly. He said the issue was serious enough to warrant involvement beyond the middle school. There should have been a district-wide email that went out to parents letting them know that this threat or this rhetoric existed and then how they handle it, Howard said. Howard said some parents who have voiced concerns did not feel comfortable speaking at the press conference because they do not feel safe. Prescott said the NAACP is shouldering a lot of complaints from parents because they feel like the school district is not listening. We need to talk about what is public safety for parents, she said. She added that she does not want to blame anyone and that she views the video as a cry for help. It's not a parent issue, but it is all of our issues, she said. Prescott and Howard said they want to work with the community and the school district to protect students and make sure everyone feels safe. That's why we're here today, Prescott said. We're here to come up with new solutions to help the school. A wreath of thanks. Wreaths Across America offers a way to thank veterans for their service after they're gone. By L.S. Arnold. In December, Arvada resident Judy Teeter will make the trip to the southwest end of Denver, where she ensures that wreaths will be laid to honor the service of thousands of veterans at a military cemetery. It's not just about laying the wreath. It's about honoring our veterans and what they did for us, Teeter said. There's a proper way to lay the wreath on the headstone, and you're also supposed to say the veteran's name and thank them for their service. Because a lot of the people that are buried out there don't have family that comes out and visits them, so we're honoring them, Teeter continued. Nearly 100 cemetery locations in Colorado will take part in a national event that pays respect to interned veterans with balsam wreaths. Volunteers like Teeter across the state work to support national nonprofit Wreaths Across America ahead of National Wreaths Across America Day, occurring this year on December 16th, according to a news release. Teeter volunteers as a coordinator for the effort to place thousands of wreaths at Fort Logan National Cemetery in Denver, near U.S. Highway 285 and Sheridan Boulevard. Roughly 120,000 veteran graves lie at Fort Logan, according to Wreaths Across America website. Teeter says her team's goal is to place 20,000 wreaths there on the day of the ceremony. She works with the cemetery administration as to what sections they want covered, because we do not have enough wreaths that are sponsored to cover the whole cemetery, Teeter said. But I have a goal to hopefully one day get all of Fort Logan covered, Teeter said. A few years ago, she found out about volunteering to place flags near headstones on Memorial Day. Through that effort, she also heard about putting out the wreaths near Christmas time, and she jumped aboard. We wouldn't be the United States of America with the freedoms that we have if it wasn't for our servicemen and women, Teeter said. Supporting our families and remembering their loved ones who served as part of our team's role. On the day of the wreath ceremony, a part of the schedule is set aside for family members who ordered a wreath for their loved one's specific grave. That starts at 1 p.m., so it's a little more quiet for the families to remember, talk to their family member, whatever traditions they have, Teeter said. Last year, there was a family who had a picnic lunch at their family's member's headstone. Looking for help. Teeter and her volunteer team work hard behind the scenes to make sure Wreaths Across America Day is a success at Fort Logan. But she's looking for more volunteers and trying to drum up more fundraising support to pay for more wreaths and help cover the costs of the operation. She's seeking support from businesses who may want to pitch in, too. From what I understand, that has been a challenge for a lot of the coordinators, is trying to get companies that can donate X amount of money to sponsor X amount of wreaths, Teeter said. She's also looking for a volunteer with fundraising experience in particular. Or somebody who says, hey, I know how to work a forklift, or somebody who says, I am a business, or I can provide a forklift or pallet jack, Teeter said. Wreaths Across America is a 501c3 nonprofit, so donating to it is considered tax deductible, according to Teeter. If you're interested in volunteering or helping as a business, you can reach Teeter at 720-329-8598 or at judy.ft.logan.waa@gmail.com. Where the money goes. Wreaths Across America was founded to continue and expand the annual wreath-laying ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia that began in 1992, according to a news release. The organization's mission is carried out in part each year by coordinating wreath-laying ceremonies in December at Arlington and thousands of veteran cemeteries and other locations in all 50 states and beyond, the release said. Local sponsorship groups registered through the national program are helping to raise the necessary sponsorships to honor service members laid to rest in participating locations. Since its founding in 2007, Wreaths Across America has partnered with thousands of local nonprofits and civic groups, according to the release. For those looking to donate, the nonprofit seeks $17 per wreath, Teeter said. But the money goes a long way. Through the nonprofit's payback program, sponsorship groups can earn $5 for every $17 veterans wreath sponsored to support these programs in their communities. By making a $17 sponsorship, you are also contributing to vital programs that make a meaningful difference in the lives of veterans and their families throughout the year, the news release stated. Some of the nonprofit's free year-round programs, according to the release, include the Mobile Education Exhibit that travels the country, visiting schools and communities, teaching the value of our freedom while acting as an official welcome home center for living Vietnam veterans. Wreath the Cross America Radio, which gives voice to volunteers and service members so that you can hear their stories of courage and inspiration. The Wreaths Across America National Museum, which is free and open to the public. It highlights the bravery and service of rank and file veterans. The Remembrance Tree Program, which creates a living memorial of service members giving back to other service members. To find a participating location or registered Wreaths Across America group to support in Colorado, visit wreathsacrossamerica.org/about/location/group search. You can donate to sponsor a wreath at wreathsacrossamerica.org/about/ways to support. You can also select an option to honor or remember a specific person at tinyurl.com/wreath-specific. There are different ways to make sure your loved one who served gets a wreath, Teeter said. If your loved one is buried at a cemetery that doesn't have a Wreaths Across America ceremony, but you still want to order a wreath, you can have it sent to you or a family member, according to Teeter. Or you can pick it up at Fort Logan at 1 p.m. December 16th, she said. For people who are out of state who order them, we have a volunteer who will place them and send a picture of the placement to the family member, Teeter said. You can reach out to Teeter at the contact information above with any questions about ordering wreaths. Reinke Brothers in Littleton files for bankruptcy after 55 years in community. Reinke Brothers, Littleton's Halloween and costume store, is facing an uncertain financial future. The business, owned by Craig and Chris Reinke, filed a Chapter 11 reorganization bankruptcy at the end of October. The business has operated for 55 years, first at the Cinderella City Shopping Center in Inglewood, and then on Littleton's Main Street since 1999. Aside from its collection of spooky decorations, costumes, and magic tricks, Reinke Brothers is also known for its annual Haunted Mansion experience. Greg Reinke declined to comment on his business bankruptcy filings, but said he wanted the community to know one thing. We're not going anywhere, he said. Greg Reinke serves as president of the Littleton Merchants Association, a group that supports and promotes Littleton's downtown business community. According to its bankruptcy filings, Reinke Brothers has almost $14,000 in assets and about $326,000 in liabilities. About 72% of its liabilities is in money owed to Statewide Roofing Consultants, Inc., a roofing company based in Littleton. Reinke Brothers owes the roofing company about $234,000, according to the bankruptcy filings. The filings state that Reinke Brothers paid about $125,000 to Statewide Roofing in a levy on October 24th, the day before it filed for bankruptcy. The two companies have been involved in civil litigation since 2016. The legal dispute concerns a roofing project conducted by Statewide Roofing on the Reinke Brothers building. Reinke Brothers has pursued claims of breach of contract, negligence, negligent misrepresentation, fraud by concealment, civil theft, and deceptive trade practices, according to court documents. The roofing company has pursued claims of breach of contract and unjust enrichment against Reinke Brothers. Reinke Brothers appealed the case in 2021, and the case is still open. Greg Reinke declined to comment on his company's legal history with the roofing company. According to the bankruptcy filings, Reinke Brothers' second largest debt owed is about $42,000 to the Arapahoe County Treasurer. The company also owes $38,000 to a company called TNT Construction Services, Inc. Residents of nearby complex displaced after fire breaks out at construction site in Littleton. A fire in an empty building under construction in downtown Littleton last night left several residents of a neighboring complex displaced. Authorities said no one was injured in the fire. South Metro Fire Rescue was dispatched at 12:17 a.m. on November 17th in response to several 911 calls reporting a three-story building engulfed in flames on the northeast corner of Main Street and South Prince Street. The fire was a second alarm fire, meaning it required double the amount of resources and personnel that are called to a regular fire, South Metro Fire Rescue spokesman Eric Hurst said. Littleton police officers on the scene evacuated the residential building next to the fire, an apartment complex at 5464 South Prince Street. The apartment building sustained external damage, but firefighters were successful in stopping the fire from spreading inside, Hurst said. The six apartment units closest to the fire sustained water damage, and their occupants will be displaced until dewatering and repairs are made, the department wrote in a post on Facebook. Fire response and damage. Firefighters used water hoses to control the flames, attacking the fire from above and from the ground. At the peak of the fire, there were about 60 firefighters responding, Hurst said. At around 2:20 a.m., the department declared the fire under control. Firefighters did not enter the structure due to its potential to collapse. Instead, they used thermal imaging drones to locate and extinguish hot spots, Hurst said. The building, which seemed to be constructed of wood and metal framing, sustained major damage, Hurst said. There's one brick wall, pretty significant in size, that is not stable and is at risk of collapsing, he said. Probably 50% of the structure's wood was consumed in the fire. He said that only some metal framing is left standing. If the building had been entirely constructed of wood, it likely would have completely collapsed and burned, he said. At around 4 a.m., the department gave permission to the building management team for the apartment complex next door to work to get their residents back in the building. The management team started working to secure doors that had been broken down before residents could return. Residents who live in the water-damaged apartments will likely be displaced until their units are repaired, Hurst said. West Metro Fire Rescue assisted in response to the scene of the fire. American Red Cross was also on scene to assist displaced residents. The Littleton Police Department was used as a temporary shelter to keep people warm and safe until their building could be reoccupied. Cause undetermined. Officials returned to the scene of the fire this morning to search debris for potential unknown victims and evidence related to the cause of the fire. Hurst said investigators specifically wanted to make sure no potential individuals were caught in the fire while using the building as a shelter, which sometimes happens in vacant buildings during colder months. After searching the scene, officials found no evidence of victims and said it is likely the cause of the fire will be undetermined. Unless there's new information that comes forward, The fire will remain an undetermined cause status, Hearst said. Investigators have reviewed all of the available evidence that they can, and at this point, they've not been able to determine a cause. Hearst said the fire marshal's office did not say the fire was suspicious, so it is equally as likely that it was an accident as a crime. Hearst said if anyone was in the area and saw something fire investigators should know, they should reach out to South Metro Fire Rescue at 720-989-2000. The fire is a good reminder for people to have a fire safety and evacuation plan, Hearst said. People who want help developing a plan can look on the fire department's website or email reducingrisk@southmetro.org. He also advised people to sign up for a RAP alert, a system that sends emergency phone notifications from first responders to people in affected areas. Individuals can sign up for a RAP alert at https://ace911.colorado.gov/RAP alert. Integrated Family Community Services to host a special program to provide meals in the community, by Elizabeth Slay. Ahead of Thanksgiving, Integrated Family Community Services, or IFCS, will host a Fresh Thanks event to provide grocery boxes for holiday meal support to the community on November 18th at Arapahoe Community College. A press release from IFCS said the event will start at noon and boxes filled with free groceries such as seasonal produce and pantry items will be distributed to 500 households in a drive-through style. The event will take place at Arapahoe Community College on the Littleton campus. Food will be distributed first come, first served, while supplies last. And all involved anticipate this to be a popular event, the press release reads. The event comes months after IFCS opened its indoor market to income-eligible families to visit to select various groceries. To support as many families as possible, the nonprofit limited household visits to twice monthly and is seeing steady increase of new visitors, the release said. The event is able to take place due to 250 volunteers who are converging early Saturday morning to sort and assemble the food boxes, as well as private donors and grant funders. From its beginning in 1964, IFCS has a nearly 60-year partnership with the community, working together to alleviate hunger, offer compassion, and help children, families, and seniors out of the downward spiral of poverty, the press release said. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.